Welcome to episode 7 of Talk Without Borders. In today's episode, I sit down with Lisa Burke. Lisa is a broadcaster, science communicator, and the voice behind the Lisa Burke Show on RTL Today. We talk about purpose, risk-taking, and the role of journalists and communicators in the modern, fast-paced media environment. Lisa also opens up about her experience in moving to Luxembourg and how this has affected her views on identity and resilience and what it truly means to start a life from scratch. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing on YouTube and other podcasting platforms. But now, without further ado, enjoy my conversation with Lisa Burke. Hello, Lisa. Welcome to my podcast.
Well, hello. It's so wonderful to be with you, and congratulations on everything that you're setting up, and particularly the fabulous name of your show, which I really love.
Oh, well, thank you. That was a certain software that helped me with the name. I want to say the name.
I think you can tell us. You can tell us, because I'm sure we will have played with it.
Right. But thank you so much for the compliment. Also, thank you so much for being on the show. I've been a long time fan of yours, because I think you're doing a little bit of a similar thing that I'm trying to do, is establish myself in the English speaking community. So I always kind of look for inspiration in your shows. But, you know, I was just thinking the other day, you know, because you're so used to giving interviews. How is it for you when, if you're on the other side of the role? So if you're the interviewee.
It's different. It's a very good question, because actually there are some interviewers who put a lot of themselves into the interview. And of course, that's a natural thing. You will always be putting yourself into the interview, but in different ways.
What do you mean when you say put yourself
into it? Some interviewers, the show is about them.
Oh, okay.
And for me, hopefully, my show is about my interviewees. So I like to be the conduit for them. Mm-hmm. So I view myself as the sieve of information to put a spotlight on them. So to your question, I do find it a little bit uncomfortable to talk about myself. Yes, it's not my comfortable place. And I only do it because if I can help anyone else, because I'm not so comfortable with the light shining on me, if it's just about, oh, here I am, me, me, me. That's not who I am as a person. I really want to be talking about something that is important or matters to another person.
Is that something that you experienced growing up as well? Because I find your journey quite interesting and fascinating. So you were born in Ireland.
Yeah.
You moved to London when you were 10 years old.
Yep.
And I think you were raised in a Catholic household, yes. If I understand it correctly.
You have a very, very good research facility going on.
Oh, there you go. You know, I used to be a journalist, so I try to make use of it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then you went to university, Cambridge, mm-hmm. and you studied chemistry. So very academic, scientific background. Mm-hmm. I think you ended up going for the PhD. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
I had a number of PhD offers.
Oh, you had a number of PhD offers.
I had accepted one. And then between my master's and PhD, I took a gap year working in the Glaxo lab in Cambridge. And in that year, I also got the chance to work at Sky News. So I was there for 6 months. And then I had to choose between Sky News and the PhD.
And I think that important pivot point was, when, if I remember correctly, that your advisor or the person you were in contact with at the time, he gave you basically a choice. He said, well, do you want to do a PhD in chemistry, or do you want to go on as a media person? So can you talk a little bit about that moment? Because I assume it was a pretty big moment in your life.
Yeah, it was Darren Dixon, who I'm still in touch with. He's a professor in Oxford now, and he's an amazing man, and I really love him. Just so inspirational to me. And he was extremely important in my life, because, you know, when you have a great teacher, he made me love organic chemistry. And I would have been his first PhD student, so it was also very, very special, and we had a really, really good bond. And he wrote to me, and he said, okay, Lisa, if you do the PhD, it will be the right choice. If you stay at Sky News, it will be the right choice. So that's what he said. By saying that, he meant there's no wrong choice, but you have to make a choice.
Mm-hmm. And why did you eventually make the choice to go into TV and not go down the route of academia further?
Well, firstly, I have to say in the UK, there isn't so much. I think it's different in Germany, for instance. In the UK, it doesn't matter if you have a PhD or not, unless you're going to go into research. Mm-hmm. And I think I couldn't envisage my life as a lab chemist. Mm-hmm. I think that was the thing. And that was one thing, even though actually I did very well. I mean, mm-hmm. I worked very hard, but I could have done it. But I didn't see that that was precisely the best way to spend the use of me. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, he is so brilliant that even though I really did very well in my exams and I got the project prize for organic chemistry, etc., and inorganic prize, actually. But anyway, on paper, I could have felt good about myself. But compared to his brilliance, I felt quite stupid. And then many years later, I said to him, you know, my God, one of the reasons I didn't do this is because, you know, you're so good. And I felt, and he said, oh, I just hide my inability with very hard work. I mean, his brilliance comes because he just works like a maniac.
Right. So I would assume that the academic background that you obviously do have, I can tell it helps you immensely in terms of being a great communicator when it comes to scientific topics, right? Because you do understand the research side, but you also understand that the lay audience doesn't necessarily understand it from the perspective of, because this is something I observe a lot, and I actually think that academics are sometimes very bad at explaining their ideas to a general audience because the general audience doesn't know the terms or doesn't really know the language. So I think your role is then in bridging that gap, right? That's something that you try to do, if I see that correctly.
I love it. I mean, that's my happiest place, is bridging that gap, getting quite tough information, scientific or otherwise. Actually, any topic, if you go in depth,
sure,
requires thought. And that's truly what I love to do. I love getting that information and trying to find the little threads that pull together into a story. That's really where I feel happiest. Yeah.
So do you, when you prepare for your shows, how much do you have your audience in mind? And I think that's a good lesson for people, I think, that want to go into media, is I think one of the most important things is having your audience in mind, right?
It is a really important point, but I think my audience is quite broad. So I sort of treat my audience as an extension of myself. And I kind of think, well, if I'm interested in this, I think it's interesting. Maybe I'm completely wrong. But in the sense that I think here in Luxembourg, we have a very international pool of people. All of RTL Today is set up to reach an international pool. And my God, we're not just trying to focus on people in Luxembourg, because that audience pool is so tiny. I really want to reach and have conversations. I mean, we're doing this online. We're not closed off by our country's borders. If our conversation is interesting enough, anybody in the world can listen to it. So I am trying to talk to an international audience about ideas that I think are important to anybody, and basically, at the end of the day, interesting to me.
So as an actress, because I think we actually have probably more in common than you think, because I've been away for so long. I lived in the US for, I think, almost 7 years. And then I come back, and it's almost like I'm a stranger in my own country. So I feel like I can relate more to expatriates in Luxembourg, that come here and basically have to start, maybe not from zero, but maybe have to start from, you know, the beginning. So how was that situation for you? Because I know you worked for a long time in the United Kingdom for Sky and other publications and news channels. So how was that transition for you into Luxembourg? And what are your views on Luxembourg, the media landscape, let's say, in Luxembourg?
Well, first of all, your story I've heard from another guy who is Luxembourgish but spent a lot of time living abroad, including the US, for many, many years. He was on my show, and he feels like an expat himself as well.
Oh, but probably Pascal. I don't know if that's what you're talking about. Yeah, I had him on my show. Yeah.
I saw. Yes.
I think we were vibing really well, because I think we were very similar in our thinking. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Exactly. You see, this is, well, I mean, you touch something there. Luxembourg is that small. So the media landscape in Luxembourg, well, I will be honest. Yes. We have amazing facilities here at RTL. The studios are amazing. I'm in a booth right now for quietness. The pace is quite slow, and it's not joined up enough across the language sections. So unfortunately, I believe it could be much more joined up across language sections. However, the audience is different. So the Luxembourgish language section is trying to target the Luxembourgish people. Mm-hmm. The French language section is, their audience is frontalier. And mm-hmm. then the English language section is international. So I do understand the audiences are different.
So I don't know how much, I don't want to divulge too many professional secrets, but do you feel like that you're a little bit detached from all the other sectors? So that's like, I think you just mentioned it.
Detached from one another. I literally was talking to the French team. It's a hard thing to... It's not just in our industry. It's in every industry in Luxembourg. It's the fact that, it's one of its amazing benefits, and it's also something that makes it hard. And I mean this on every level, because somebody was literally just talking to me yesterday about, mm-hmm. Because it was May Day and there was these wonderful processions going through my village. And I thought, oh, wow, it's so amazing. We have this wonderful community. And then I was going into a further conversation, and I know that the English-speaking expats don't always get involved in their local, not always get involved in their local council decisions. Mm-hmm. And my friend who was American was saying to me, oh, well, why is that? And I said, well, really, I think it's because we usually don't speak Luxembourgish. And most of these meetings take place primarily in Luxembourgish and then French, which is fine. And it's as it should be. But the language, Luxembourgish people are amazing at speaking so many languages. Generally speaking, unfortunately, English speaking people are not so much, because everybody reverts back to English so often. And the minute they have a hint of you speaking English, it's like, oh, they speak English. That's an excuse, but maybe we're lazy as well. All of these things. But the language thing is incredible in Luxembourg, but it also creates silos.
Yeah, and I heard that argument before from other people about the silos. So when you look at your audience, do you primarily consider them to be expatriates, English-speaking people, or do you consider also that there might be some Luxembourgers that are listening in?
Of course.
And how do you separate that, or do you not want to separate it, or like how do you go about treating those different audiences?
I don't want to separate it. I view English as a tool language. I mean, English, I am very conscious that we are gifted with a language that most Luxembourgish people can speak. So I know that I have Luxembourgish people listening, and that's very, very important. I am very sensitive to the issue that I we're here living in a country using a different language. I'm incredibly sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. So I know that I have a pool of Luxembourgish listeners, which I'm very grateful for. I know that obviously we have English mother tongue speakers. I know that much of Eastern European people speak English as their second language. Mm-hmm. Most of the Middle East speak English as their second language, sometimes even first language. Then we've got, the Indian diaspora. There's so many other, subcontinents where English is the vehicle language. Mm-hmm. It used to be that French was the second language of Europe, perhaps, but it's become more and more English, I think. So I am deeply conscious that I have a multilingual listenership, and I think that brings great diversity. And you'll know from my guests, they speak all different languages.
So was that something you had in mind? Because I think you were very, very heavily involved in creating RTL Today, right? Which is basically the platform for English-speaking content in Luxembourg. So how did you come about creating this? What was the thought process behind that?
Well, the thought process was, I know that I would like to work in news. Mm-hmm. This platform does not yet exist in English. Therefore, I would like to create it.
But you had to convince someone, right?
I wrote to the CEO of RTL. Okay. I told him this would be a good idea.
And he said, yes, it's a good idea, and you're good to go?
Well, he did say, yes, that's a good idea. And then it took about 9 months of planning with my ex-business partner on very little pay. I mean, we had to sell an idea, which is what any entrepreneurship idea is. You're selling an idea, a vision to people. You're saying, hey, we are going to create this. Would you like to come and work for not a lot of money? We're setting out from scratch. We have to make proof of concept, etc. But not once did I think it wasn't a good idea. Of course, I could see absolutely this doesn't exist in Luxembourg. I could see many, many reasons why it was important. And yes, it's important.
Is that something that's, because you said at the beginning you worked for very little pay. Are you driven by meaning or extrinsic meaning more so than, you know, financial rewards? Is that something that's important to you? Purpose, I guess, is the better.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if we are lucky enough in life to be able to work with purpose, that will feed our souls. And that's what we should all try to aim for. Mm-hmm. Not everybody gets that option in life, you know, generationally, you know, that hasn't always been an option for people. I will also say two things. One is that I have seen in Luxembourg a lot of unhappy people who end up in burnout because they're so misaligned with their core values, but they can't give up the work that's literally making them sick because they have golden handcuffs. They have well-paying jobs and expensive lives, and they're not willing to give that up for a gamble in the dark. Oh, and I understand that. It would literally mean they either need to have a total burnout breakdown or be made redundant before they would give that up. Mm-hmm. And I completely understand it because it's very tough to do that. So that's one thing. The second thing I want to say is I will never diminish the importance of having financial security because I know it myself. I know it as someone who's gone through divorce. And to any woman who has been a trailing spouse mm-hmm. and has had to start from scratch and build up their own lives again, because it's usually the female trailing spouse that gives up their work to follow. And of course, a lot of my listeners will be expats where this is the case, to follow their usually husband's work around the world. They give up their career for a decade, whatever, and they have to start from scratch. And if things go wrong in their lives, without a financial buffer, it removes choice. Mm-hmm. So both are important. To answer your question, you have to have a financial buffer of security, and I won't diminish that. However, if you can build your life around what you care about and really dig inside yourself to find out what that is, you will be very, very happy.
Is that something, because you said that, were you speaking about your personal experience when you said that you have to start from scratch because you went to some personal problems yourself? So is that something that's important for you, teaching other people, or not teaching, because that might be a little condescending, but sharing your experience with other people,
yeah,
right?
That's why I talk about it, because I am actually quite a personal person. People might not think that because of my job.
So an introvert, essentially.
I am. Okay. Yeah. But also I keep some things for me. I don't share all of my life on social media or everything. However, I will talk about things if I think it will help another person. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I followed my ex-husband's work from London to Abu Dhabi, then back to London and then to Luxembourg. So I followed his work around while our daughters were very small. And in doing so, everywhere I went, it took minimum 18 months to settle our daughters. Mm-hmm. During that, I never do nothing. It's not who I am. Mm-hmm. So in Abu Dhabi, I did a lot of music and I wrote for the national newspaper. Back in London, I had to resettle the girls. I did a lot of music and I wrote children's science books, which I've done always. And then in Luxembourg, that's when, after 8 months, he moved out. And then I had to figure out, do I stay here or do I move back to London? Mm-hmm. And I stayed, obviously, because I was too exhausted to move back to London.
Oh, so I was going to ask. So basically, you just didn't have the energy to move another time, essentially.
Emotionally, mm-hmm. it had been incredibly hard. And it wasn't just about me, of course. If you have children, you are not making a decision just for yourself. Most mothers are making a decision for the family unit, which is the other member of the family. It sits above the family, in my opinion. There's a bigger story here that's been seen by, for example, and I'll share the story precisely because I happen to know LIST, which is the Luxembourg Institute of Science and Technology. Mm-hmm. They had put out a post for some job and they were specifically trying to get a woman to fill the post, which I know is positive discrimination, but they did that. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the head of HR was specifically targeting women. She was finding and writing to them on LinkedIn. And she wrote to men as well. Mm-hmm. All of the men replied. Mm-hmm. And not many of the women replied. So she had to contact them again and ask, why are you not applying for this role? And so the men applied instantly, not considering their family. They thought the family will just move if I get this job. The women specifically did not apply because they were thinking primarily of their family and not uprooting the children and the whole lives of the family. So this is one difference that is seen over and over again.
So this is a very common problem, especially in the US, about the STEM field, that there is a discrepancy in terms of gender roles. So you're saying that part of that discrepancy can be explained by the fact that women tend to be more feeling responsible for their children and therefore don't want to go in demanding jobs that have demanding schedules. Is that...
That's connected but separate. It's more that they didn't want to move country because it would disrupt the entire life of their child, whereas the men had not considered that. They just assumed the children will move. But your point is also valid and true also in that women carry a mental load that is different to a man. That mental load means things like dentist appointments, school things, There's always that mental load, and it's proven to be different to a man. It's just different. All I'm saying is that it's a different mental load. And coming back to why I stayed in Luxembourg, I was always making a decision. Why did I move to Luxembourg? I stayed back in London for a year before I moved here. I moved to Luxembourg because my youngest daughter thought we should be together as a family.
Oh, because she was still in Luxembourg, or she was... Did you move back with your children to London at the time, or were they staying here?
No, my ex-husband moved to Luxembourg a year before we moved.
Okay.
And I was trying to make a decision because it was a very pivotal point for our eldest daughter school-wise and exams they have to do in London for schools, etc. What should we do? And because I had also moved from Ireland to England when I was 10, I knew exactly what that felt like. I know precisely what it feels like to be uprooted from a village in Ireland when Facebook and all of the rest did not exist to London and overnight lose all connection to your entire past and live in an entirely different world. So I know what that loss feels like and that cultural change. And so I wanted to involve my daughters in every step of the decision-making process. And it was my younger daughter, surprisingly, who felt that need to be together as a family.
So, and I think this story of yours talks a little about integration and cultural identity. So what is your perception of people that come to Luxembourg? I mean, you did it yourself, but I think you're in touch with many other people that come here. How do you think, how well is Luxembourg doing, let's say, in integrating people that are, let's say, English speaking or not necessarily first language or maybe second language, and then they come here? So what is your view on that?
That's an impossible question to answer because it has so many factors. You know, are you coming as a single person? Are you coming as a single person to work here? What age are you as a single person? Do you want to go out and have fun, like in a big city? Well, you're not going to find that in Luxembourg. You know, you might as well be in...
Well, no, not yet. Maybe in the city a little bit, but
A little bit. Yeah. It depends where you come from. I mean, it also depends where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Are you coming from, I don't know, a village in France? Are you coming from New York?
No, if you're coming from London, then obviously there's no comparison. Yeah.
Yeah, but it depends what you want. Do you want a more tranquil life? Do you like what you like? But then your question is more towards integration.
Yes.
Are you a trailing spouse? Are you a trailing spouse with or without children? Which school will you choose for your children? Is it going to be the local school, in which case they will get the local language, but then how are you going to integrate? The local school will be in your village or town, so you'll be close to the friends and family, but people are not at the school gate like in other countries that I know. So there's so many factors there. Are you working? Are you not working? Are you going to volunteer? So as an example, before I moved, I knew one of my integration tools is I sing. So I checked out every single choir that I could find on the internet before I came here. And then I tried out different choirs and I joined a choir because I know the kind of people I meet in choir. They're good people. We have a shared love of doing something else outside of ourselves. I guess that would be something that's key to my existence. And it was wonderful. So I met lovely people in my choir. There are lots of ways to meet people in Luxembourg, but you do have to have the confidence to attend these things. And I also know what it feels like to attend a networking event and then people say, oh, what do you do? And you have to say, oh, well, I'm not sure what I do yet. I'm trying to figure that out. I've just arrived here and I'm trying to figure out what do I do.
Well, here's my view on this, because I kind of carry two sorts. I don't know how to speak. So because I am from here, but I'm also American in a way. I don't know. I think I just I've lived there for so long and I know so many people. So I've got to socialize myself. So I think Luxembourg is still quite conservative in a lot of things, in a lot of views. And I think because you said you were at a networking event and somebody asked you and you said, oh, I don't know what I do.
Well, or I'm an entrepreneur. I didn't say that, but it's what I thought.
Oh, what you were thinking. Yeah. Maybe you're not sure of yourself because you're still trying to, you're an entrepreneur. Maybe you're trying to build something. But I think Luxembourg is still very conservative when they say, well, why don't you get a job? Why don't you go work for the government? You know, and you have a steady pay, you have a good paycheck, you have a safe life, no risks. You know, you're going to have social security later when you stop working, you'll be fine, right? So I think part of the, I want to say maybe an issue with Luxembourg is that they don't really encourage risk. So, you know, it's like play, and I think you touched on that earlier before. It's like the idea of play it safe, you know, because if you play it safe, then, you know, you'll be fine. You wouldn't have to worry about anything. So that's my perspective on this.
Yeah, but you also know that expats, we can't have a job as a fonctionnaire.
So you don't have a choice in a way. Yes, you have to create something for yourself.
At least within the first 5 years, and certainly not without speaking all of the languages, which most of us don't. Well, a lot of people don't manage that. But also, oh, my Lord, I do know some people who do that, and they're not all happy people.
Do you know some people that do what exactly?
I have friends that I know well who are Luxembourgish and do these civil service jobs, and they do it for the money and the security, but they don't like it at all.
Oh, yeah. That's very common. Yeah, of course. And you mentioned that before, and you said you were in somewhat of a privileged position because you get to do something that you enjoy.
Well, privileged, but I created it.
I didn't mean that you didn't earn it, but it's still, I meant the privilege in a sense where you have that opportunity that other people didn't create for themselves or don't have, or maybe don't have the, you know, because they don't have the options that we do.
And they have the options. They may not have the courage.
Or the courage or any other circumstances that there may be. So I think, and because a lot of people don't take those risks, because for you, it was also about taking a risk, right? And I think they'll just play it safe because that way, you know, they get, and then, like you say, that tends to lead to unhappiness, I think, because you're not fulfilled. You do something that you don't enjoy, and obviously that's not going to make you happy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have a very clear example of a woman I know doing that job that she is completely underused in. She is not happy, but her husband encourages her to continue this job because it's very safe. And he says, and I know where he's coming from as well, in his background, but it's very safe. It's well paid. They get the holidays, they get the sick pay, etc. You know, I don't get that. I don't get holidays or sick pay. I carry on.
No, we don't get that. But I think it's a trade-off, right? It's true we don't get that, but then maybe we get to do something that we enjoy a little bit more than others. So I think that's the trade-off that we have, essentially.
We get to choose who we spend time with.
Yes, exactly. And we get to choose the schedule in a way, too. So that's something I think that's really important. But I want to pivot to another topic that I find quite interesting, the engagement with media online. And that's something I actually studied a lot. You know, and there was the whole emergence of fake news, obviously, you know, and you know, with Trump and all the different the cultural factors that arose out of that. So what is your view on what should the media do? What is the role of the media when relaying information at any kind, made political, entertainment, of sorts?
Well, this is a huge question. And given that you have studied it and got a PhD in it, I think you are certainly the one who should be telling us. However, I think it's incredibly important. I just had lunch today with a lady who works with the Red Cross. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about, she's been on missions all around the world. And, you know, we can have people at war because they simply cannot see the other side. The narrative that they are brought up with and living with is so at odds with the narrative of the other side, the communication, the narrative. It's all about the narrative and trusting the narrative. So obviously, or at least I say it's obvious, I would like to belong, and we are privileged to live in a place where we have freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. Another example today, I also had a meeting with somebody who was talking about, they were actually talking about RTL in Hungary, where apparently Orban's government put a 50% tax on RTL's revenues, not profits, revenues, and tried to destroy RTL in Hungary. Mm. And the head of the RTL group was also attacked, and other people in mm-hmm. RTL. So we are very lucky. We are really lucky to be able to talk about whatever we want to talk about, freedom of speech, mm-hmm. fact-checking, and being a source of trust is incredibly important to me. Mm-hmm. I'm culturally aware enough to know, and I've interviewed a number of people from different places, including, I mean, Israel, Palestine, for instance. Mm-hmm. I have lived in places where I understand the mindset of somebody is completely shaped by what they have been fed growing up and where they live. And that's not their fault. That's, they are the product of where they've grown. We are the product of where we've grown up. I would wish for media to be open and transparent and to be thought-provoking, conversations that matter, and to inspire and to be a source of trust. Now, also this week, I've come off the back of, an AI for Creators week, where I've literally seen how we can create anything from text to image to video to voice. Somebody could replicate my voice. There's enough of my voice out there.
Yeah, they can do deep fakes now.
They can absolutely do that right now today. That can happen. Mm-hmm. Please don't do that.
I won't.
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to whoever may listen to this.
You're saying please don't use my...
Please don't do that. No, yeah. But I know that that's possible right now today.
Yes.
So we're on the precipice of an unknown. I really cannot see what the future is.
Oh, it's very hard to predict, I agree.
Yeah. All I know is that we come back once more, I think, to two things. The power of truth and a strong narrative. That's very, very important. I'll just give you one other example. This week when I was hosting this event about the AI for creatives, and one of the first speakers, a professor who is, an expert in his topic, only afterwards he told me he was nervous coming on stage to give his talk. And he said what helped him was, just as he was coming on, I shook his hand, I looked in his eyes, and he said that 1 second worth of human touch and transaction completely calmed him down. Mm-hmm. And it was so kind of him to tell me this story, but I'm only repeating the story to say that the human touch and the human element in our work, in all work, not just our work, I do hope that will remain important.
So, let's stay on the AI topic, because obviously that's something that's going to be enormously important. Mm-hmm. So, if I understood you correctly, you're saying for you, you really encourage the development in AI, but it's important for you that we keep the human element. Is that right?
I don't know that I encourage the development of AI or not. It's happening. It's happening all around us.
Oh, yeah, it is happening. Yes.
I mean, that's not a question. That's mm-hmm. not a choice. It's going to happen. It is happening. It's already present. And we need to be on it mm-hmm. because if we're not, somebody else is.
So you're not necessarily positive toward it. You're just saying you have to accept that it is here to stay and we just have to deal with it.
Absolutely. But I want to lean into, I mean, I think it's both. I think it's positive and negative. I think there'll be both. Just like with social media, just like with the internet, just like with screen time. I think there are incredible positives in the future, and there will also be negatives. There will be both.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to predict where we're heading with this. But I agree 100% with you. It is here to stay, and it's going to develop. And for all the people that are listening and that are resisting the change, it won't do you any good, because it's going to stay, like you said. So
there's it's there. It's on everything that we're using. Everything has it and will continue to. Every time you open up your phone, there's a new thing on it.
So I just want to touch back on, because you mentioned something about the truth is important. And I think it's increasingly more difficult. I want to use the perspective from the US because I think, just to get a little political here, I think what Trump has done is he has created some sort of post-truth society where I think somebody mentioned that and he said he could go and say New York Times and BBC is fake news, but then go on Alex Jones' podcast and say that this is like great journalism, right? So basically, he's perverted our perceptions or the perception of many people, what is truth, so that many people don't know what is truth anymore. And so I feel like there's some sort of cynicism that has developed as an extent of that. Is that something that you also see, that people are very unsure what is true or they can't really trust? And they say, I think they do polls and I think media trust is an all-time low in the US, certainly. I don't know if it's the same in Europe. Is that something that you also see here reflected a little bit?
I think good media companies or good institutions are working incredibly hard to fact check and to really put teams of people on fact checking. I know RTL Deutschland do this. I interviewed a guy there very recently who's doing that. And he said he doesn't mind if their news is slower, but he tries very hard to make, I mean, they do all they can to fact check. And I mean, it comes back to the basics of journalism, which is checking your facts.
I guess my point is, and I know there's so many good journalists that do a great job at checking facts and doing great stories, but I guess my point is that because I think people have been corrupted by, or I would, let's say, gaslit in a way that, so that they don't, like, you could give them all the facts and you could lay it all out, but they still won't believe you because they say, well, Trump says it's fake news, so I don't believe you. And I think this is so incredibly hard to push against that, because that's some sort of cognitive dissonance. I think it's just so hard to break through.
Yeah. I mean, it's, if I was to think that way, it's a very scary world. But I mean, we can see that's what war is about. You've just described the fact that a person has a completely different mindset, mm-hmm. and whatever they are being told.
Mm-hmm. They're like inoculated against whatever you tell them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my whole mind, I have come from a science background where for me, I mean, my family group chat, with my daughters and my ex-husband, mm-hmm. he rechanged it one day to call it, it's just the facts.
It's just the facts. And of course, it's only facts.
It was a joke at me. It was a joke at me, mm-hmm. because I try to operate on facts. Mm-hmm. That's how I was mentally trained to operate
on facts. Of course, as a good academic and with some media background. Yeah, you should be trained that way, right?
But of course, the whole world of social media and the whole world of marketing, mm-hmm. is all about how are you making another person feel? I mean, look at the over-sexualization of young girls and where is that coming from? You know, people have fought so hard for that to not be the case and then they're doing it to themselves. There's so many things, you know, and what you're saying is a person might not listen to the actual words. I mean, a ton of people voted for Trump knowing full well what he had done and what he was accused of.
Yep. Yep.
That wasn't the most important thing to them. So they were voting for other reasons. And I know, well, one person, I know a number of people, one person who is my friend who's, mm-hmm. voted for him, who is a very intelligent person, mm-hmm. highly intelligent.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure you know the same as well. And he knows precisely who Trump is as a person, but he didn't vote for that. There are different reasons. And unfortunately, in the US, they don't have enough choice, perhaps.
I mean, I always say, I gave people the benefit of the doubt for electing Trump or voting for Trump the first time. But I just don't know how you watch the last 8 years, including his first presidency and then everything in between, and you thought it was a good idea to vote for him a second time. That is quite actually, in a way, almost fascinating to me. That probably deserves its own study of like human minds and how they work. It's like how people can convince themselves to vote for him a second time.
A while ago, I don't know when, because I was just listening to this secondhand. Somebody reminded me of it today. There was apparently in France every year they have a survey for 18 to 24-year-olds or 35-year-olds. So young adults in France, they ask the same questions every year. And in this particular recent survey, one of the questions was, what is your faith in democracy? And a very high percentage have no faith in democracy. And so one could look at what's happening in the US and see, oh, right, they're trying to upend democracy. They're trying to start from zero. I mean, some people, I'm only putting out one potential argument.
I actually agree. I think that is what the Trump administration is trying to do, but it's a separate point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we could go down a whole black hole.
Yeah. I don't want to get, it got us too deep in that hole. Yeah. But mm-hmm. I think your point is that there is, people think that, so what was the point of the survey? The survey was to show that young people fear that this is going to end democracy, or what was the result?
The survey is something I believe they do every year with young people, or every, I don't know, I don't know when, I don't know, all I remember is this fact. Mm-hmm. But I think however often they do the survey, they ask the same questions. And I think it's to monitor change in young people. Mm-hmm. Over time. But this particular question was about democracy, and the answer to this question was young people have no faith in current democratic systems.
Right. So do you think it's similar in Luxembourg?
Because no, I don't.
No, you don't? Okay.
But
how
there's
so?
A different problem in Luxembourg.
What is that?
No, I think people in Luxembourg feel they, well, first of all, there's a lot of choice of politicians. Secondly, you can literally reach out and probably knock on their door or call them and have
a conversation. That is very unique about Luxembourg. Agreed.
Yeah. Or find them in a market or something, mm-hmm. really.
No, you can run into, I think, Bettel, for example, the market at a Sunday, right? Talk to him, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's almost famous for that. The problem, if I may say, in Luxembourg is that the only people who can vote are Luxembourgers. And yes, expats can get a passport, and we should bother more. I say we. Once you've lived here for 5 years and you've passed B2 level of Luxembourgish, you can get a passport. Or if you've lived here for over 20 years, whatever. The point remains, a lot of expats don't vote. And also it's a transient system. Mm-hmm. They don't vote for who's in charge governmentally of Luxembourg. And the reason this is an issue is that the people who pay for the fonctionnaires and the government mm-hmm. are the taxpayers. We pay their wages, mm-hmm. but we don't vote. But that, I mean, it comes back to us. That's our fault for not learning Luxembourg.
But do you think there should be at least an option where expatriates could be included in the voting process, or outside of getting the Luxembourgish citizenship?
I do, yes.
So how would that work? Do you in practice? Because I think I agree with you, because there's such a high percentage of foreigners in Luxembourg, it is quite strange. And like you said, they work here and they pay taxes, so it is quite strange that they're excluded from the democratic process of voting.
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to learning the language. And the thing is, truly, that's also important for integration. I do also respect that. It's just that if you are an expat here in Luxembourg, starting from scratch, Luxembourgish wouldn't be the most useful language to start with. To be honest, I don't think it would be, depending on what industry you're in. But one would perhaps say French might be a more useful.
Yeah, I think. That's what everybody tells people that come here. The first thing they'll say is learn French and then you're good.
And then Luxembourg. Yeah. And so it's all about time. I mean, the truth is, of course, one should respect the country you're in and respect the language and kind of put down roots in a different way. Of course, that is the truth. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If I could find the time to learn Luxembourgish or make it a priority, that would be brilliant. I have a very long to-do list, and
I actually don't think. I mean, even I'm from Luxembourg. The problem with Luxembourg is we don't even know our grammar. So we don't even value. So I guess my point is even value the language. So how can we expect other people that come here to value the language?
I understand it from the point of view that, you know, I've come from Ireland, and when I was growing up in Ireland, my parents didn't push. We had to do Irish at school, of course, mm-hmm. but they didn't push the learning of Irish as a fundamental need, because they viewed it as a dead language. My father would say, well, mm-hmm. why would you need Irish when, you know, nobody's going to use it?
Exactly.
That's really changed, actually. The use of Irish has really kind of, you know, been built up again to save the languages and to save the culture. And mm-hmm. it has a completely different turn of phrase. It's a beautifully poetic language. It's a gorgeous language. So from the point of view of language, I completely understand it. And it's really important. And it's great for integration. All of that is true. But from the point of view of voting and having a say in how a country is run, where we live and really pay to live and, you know, put our hard and cash, you know, into mm-hmm. the, I do believe we should have a right to vote. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that something that you have discussed with policymakers before?
Yeah.
And what is the reaction you usually get?
What I was told was the people who put it forward as an option a while back, they said I believe it was a referendum. It was before I moved to Luxembourg. They said it wasn't done as well as it should have been, because obviously they put it forward believing that expats should be able to vote. I mean, obviously the people who are voting for this are also Luxembourgish people, and perhaps that, you know, I also understand they don't want their country overrun by people who are from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do understand that side too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think because we're so multicultural and we have so many languages, and I haven't really thought about this, but just when you said it, that, yeah, it is true that, you know, foreigners actually don't get to vote, but they pay taxes and they're so involved that they should actually be integrated. So do you think that Luxembourg's, that actually brings me to another point, the diversity, the media diversity, do you think there's enough of diversity in media reaching enough people and presenting diverse viewpoints?
Well, of course, the issue here is that we will all also get our media from wherever we've come from. So I don't know where you get your media, but I remember many years ago when I first moved here, a Luxembourger saying that he watches his news in German and French. You know, there's a lot of people getting their news from surrounding countries. Mm-hmm. And I will True. Always revert back to UK news mostly. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's very important to have news from your country as well, and to feel that's a point of integration as well, to feel like you're connected to your country. Mm-hmm. So that's why another reason RTL Today is a success, because people want to feel a connection and they want information of, you know, where they are living. Is there diversity here? Well, it's not really big enough for huge diversity, is it?
Yeah, I mean, but I'm going to give you one example. So, for example, if you look at TV, right, in Luxembourg, you have one TV station, which is RTL, mm-hmm. and you have a country of 600,000 people. I think that's not enough. But I think when it comes to radio, for example, there's quite a bit more choice, right? You have 100.7, and, you know, you have other stations. But I think it would probably be beneficial if you had more media diversity in terms of just, because at one point, if you have, for example, just one TV station, that could lead to some sort of monopolization, corruption, and other processes. So I think personally, it's important to have that diversity in media.
I agree. And I think there's a reason, I don't know what it is, because obviously I brought up the question about TV here in English. Well, one is a question of cost, you know, doing the same thing in three different languages. Well, not doing the same thing in three. I would believe there's a space for something in English on RTL, on TV.
For example,
of course. I do believe that. I think it's something to do with the way it's funded and what they have to do, their remit mm-hmm. and languages. I don't know precisely. However, we have got video of our radio studios. The other thing to add in is, of course, who watches TV anymore?
That's a good point. Yeah, I think it's shifting to the internet more and more. I want to just revert back to a personal aspect that I'm actually personally curious about. When you prepare for your shows mm-hmm. and your guests, mm-hmm. what is the criteria that you use to select these guests, and what are the criteria you use?
I think it's quite simple. I try to have a mix of stories that come from Luxembourg or pass through Luxembourg or just interesting ideas and interesting people. Mm-hmm. But the point of connection is that it has to be interesting and thought-provoking.
So do you think about the audience as well when you craft these guest lists?
Yeah, in the sense that I know that they can get very high discussions on politics and economics and basically any topic they want on any platform out there. So how can I be a point of difference? Well, I'm based in Luxembourg. I have a very international audience and a very international pool of people that swing by Luxembourg or pass through my life. And if I just catch a glimpse of an interesting idea or an interesting person, I want to be the megaphone for that person and share that idea. And then there is some interesting work that's done in Luxembourg as well. The criteria is that it has to be something interesting, hopefully impactful, will leave the audience thinking more deeply about something. And it's just a little bit of an, oh, okay, that makes me think.
But you mentioned earlier that you are more of an introvert. That's quite interesting, because when I listen to you or your shows, it doesn't seem like you are an introvert. It seems like you are an extrovert and you like to put yourself out there and talk to people. So how is that, or is that just a bad perception, I guess, that I have?
No, I think I'm both. I think it's because it's not about me. Again, you know, it's not about me. It's about, if I meet somebody, I want to know about them. I want to know about their ideas. Yeah, I'm on stage a lot for the work that I do. But again, it's about the work. It's not about me. And I have no problems being on stage. But you also have to remember, I started public speaking at the age of 11. I've done an awful lot of music on stage. So all of the fear has been kind of like burned out of me a bit. I did live television for 10 years with an earpiece in my ear. You know, so I've had a lot of experience. I've done a lot of singing. So I've had enough physical training for that aspect to be sort of inured.
So are you saying that you are more of an introvert, but the constant exposure has kind of like made you not pay attention to maybe anxiety or other things that people have when they speak in front of the public?
I've had a lot of practice. The reason I say I'm an introvert is that some people, and I mean, I don't know him personally very well. I've met him a few times. Xavier Bettel, for example, seems to have copious amounts of energy and could meet 100 people in one day and still have more energy to meet 100 people that night without ever burning out. If I do an event, but it's for different reasons. Look, for example, this week I was in this event in Berlin. Mm-hmm. I prepare very, very hard before the event with the team intensely. Then the event requires 100% of my focus, absolute focus on it. And then the day after, I need to recuperate. I need to be quiet. I need to be in the forest with my dog. I need to just be silent. Yeah. And so that's what it is. But that's because, you know, when I'm doing an event or something like that, that requires 100% of me, I have to have recuperation time.
Yeah, sure. Those are like the telltale sign of an introvert, because I'm the same way. Where if I have an event or networking event, or I go to talk to people, you know, a lot of the times there's some small talk involved, and then it's like it's draining my battery in a way, and then I need to recharge. Mm-hmm. And I think extroverts, it's the opposite, where they have to constantly talk to people, otherwise they feel sad, I guess. And so you're saying that you're actually more of an introvert is quite interesting.
Well, that's what I need to do. I know that I need to preserve my energy. I mean, for other reasons also, there is only me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't, like we said earlier, I'm not going to get paid for sick days. And also, I don't want to let people down. So if I have promised to do an event, I need to be well. I need to make sure I give 100% of myself. I have two daughters and I manage everything on my own. I mean, their dad helps with them, of course, but everything that's, you know, running in my life, I manage. And so there's only me to fall back on. So if I don't preserve my energy, nobody else is going to do that for me.
And I think another aspect that people probably don't understand is if you prepare for some of these events or a show or something that you're hosting, I think it takes also a lot of mental energy to be prepared for the conversation, to engage with the people. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about what that process is like just for the people out there, because I think you make it look very effortless, but there's obviously a lot of practice behind that, right?
Well, The main key message is listening to what they're saying. So normally I always try to have a prep chat with the guests beforehand. Mm-hmm. And in that prep chat, I'm listening to how do they speak? How easy are they at speaking in English? How do they come across? What is their turn of phrase? What is their expression? They could say almost anything, but the prep chat is...
I guess you're scanning them in a way.
I'm getting a feel for how they will develop a conversation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how I can integrate them into a group conversation. Mm-hmm. So they could be talking about their subject. They are always talking about their subject, in fact, but I am actually listening.
Does that help? Does that help you, that response that you get in that moment, does that help you create the flow for the conversation later on? Is that the purpose?
Yeah. Yes, it does. And also it's an icebreaker between us if I haven't met them before. And then, of course, the other thing is I want to know, what do they care most about? What do they really light up at? What do they love to talk about? Because if I can shine a light on that, then the interview is amazing. Because when I was working at Sky News, and in that era of interviews in the UK, there were a lot of interviewers who were notorious for being very tough, mm-hmm. you know, very brutal and very, I'm going to be really hard on you. And I never felt that was a good approach. Personally, I thought, what are you trying to prove by doing that? You know, for me, I think if you can put a person at ease, and I see it very often with my interviewees, I see it in the room, or if they're online, but mostly if they're present in person, I see when they relax. I can mm-hmm. literally feel when they relax. Mm. And a lot of my interaction with them, it's not just about the preparation of the topic. A lot of it, it's the feeling.
I just want to hop on that real quick, don't interrupt you. But isn't there also a difference if the person that you're interviewing is not a professional versus somebody that's, you know, well-versed and trained in media?
Yeah, there is.
So are you seeing your role more so for people that maybe don't speak in front of a camera that often or not used to speaking in public? Or are you using the strategy for both people that, you know, maybe like a prime minister who has done a million interviews, you're probably approaching that differently than, let's say, a scientist who hasn't really spoken in public and now you're talking to him?
It's really both.
Okay.
And it's not a strategy. It's actually just who I am. Mm-hmm. But it's what I believe in. It's not like I'm going out of my way to kind of trip them up by being nice. I believe that if I can put a person at ease, they will feel more open to telling me their story or whatever it is.
And I guess my point is that you maybe need to do that more for people that are not used to speaking in public.
Yes, I do. I am very aware. That is correct. I'm very aware of those who need more help. Mm-hmm. And I do try to absolutely put them at ease. What I see with more experienced people, still, if I can put them at ease in a different way, mm-hmm. I might get a different angle to a story.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're saying your general nature, that's just who you are. So would you say that because you say it's so important that you listen to people, and that you're, in a sense, empathetic. Let's say you have a very sad story or something that is, does it happen to you that you personally, this really touches you and maybe it stays with you over a couple of days? Or are you very professional in a sense that you're like, once the interview is over, then you just move on and prepare, let's say, for the next one?
Oh, no, of course it touches me. And I have a number of examples of that happening. Mm-hmm. But the first time I can tell you, when I came across something that was almost unbearable to imagine, mm-hmm. and I wasn't the one interviewing them, because in fact, it was the news story. But I was at Sky News when it was happening. And of course, when I was at Sky News, I was literally working in a place of 24-hour news all the time. And actually, when I went home, I had to kind of just break and watch something like America's Next Top Model or something randomly ridiculous mm-hmm. to just avoid news for a while mentally. It was the story of, I can't remember the man's name. Mm-hmm. He was an Austrian man who had locked his daughter in the basement in a cellar and had raped.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, we know that story.
Multiple times mm-hmm. yeah. through her life, and had children with her, and some mm-hmm. of the children had died. She'd had to give birth by herself. These children had never seen daylight. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a very disturbing story, remember, at the time.
That's
so were you were you involved in the news reporting about this, or just
I was in Sky News when the reporters were working on this story and when this story came to light. That story is one of the hardest stories I remember because my children were very young at the time. I remember also the before and after you have a child. And I know I'm not alone in this because I know other women, the before and after, where especially when the children are young, you're in a different emotional state. And certain stories, for instance, Madeleine McCann going missing.
Mm-hmm.
That story hit a lot of young mothers who worked in media very strongly. It just hits you in a different way, and it's quite hard to remove your own life from that. But I think our role, it's very much like there are many jobs out there where you acquire this. You know, doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, anybody who works in, you know, international development where you're working in war zones. There are so many jobs where you can be very close to extreme pain.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to build up a way to be both empathetic, but to also care about yourself.
Yeah, I call it resilient. So I guess you want to be empathetic and resilient, mm-hmm. because if you're only empathetic, you wouldn't get anything done.
You lose yourself. You cannot lose yourself. You have to stay present. You have to have an inner calm and an inner ear. And you can be absolutely 100% compassionate and 100% empathetic, but also hold yourself.
I think those are very powerful words. Thank you very much, Lisa. I know you're very busy. I really appreciate you taking your time, talking about your life, your experience. And yeah, I think your listeners are going to like it.
Well, congratulations to you for everything that you've done and everything that you're bringing to Luxembourg with fresh new Luxembourg eyes.
Well, I'm trying my best, but thank you.
You're doing a great job. And if there's any way that I can support you, I'm here.
All right. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.